slide into the black desert.
I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion.
I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos.
Can't get no sleep.
Hello and welcome to the Mile High Sanity Project.
I love that intro.
This is Alternatives to Thought. I'm Chal Marin. I'm here with Norman Schultz.
Hello.
And Nick Arcus.
Hey, everyone.
And Joel Katormson as well.
How's it going?
And today we want to talk about human evolution and some of the misconceptions about human evolution, some of the objections to human evolution, and just overall the concept that human beings are somehow distinct from the animal world, that we are special, different, that we did not evolve.
Wait a minute. There are people object to human evolution since when? Is that new?
For quite some time.
Really?
Oh, yes. There's this idea that we are, in fact, golems constructed of mud with life breathed through our nostrils by some sort of ephemeral, all-powerful entity with nothing better to do. Anyway.
You know, just the verbal issue of the fact that there's a word for humans, people, and then animals. Like, animals are all... That distinction of calling them animals separates us from them.
And it's different from the distinction of, say, Homo sapien.
Right.
To say humans versus animals, it's a unique way of talking about ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Norm, you don't see humans in zoos, do you? I rest my case.
Not yet.
I don't know. When I visit an engineering department, I have been known to tap on glass here and there.
I see That's lots true. Of humans at the zoo.
Chalmers sees a lot of humans at the zoo.
How do you think they stay open, Nick?
That's true. Don't feed the animals, including humans.
They charge us for admittance. The animals get in for free.
True.
Well, I think the chimpanzees have just a discount.
Sure, yeah. So before we get into any of this, we need to talk about carbon dating and radiometric dating in general.
Well, okay, before we get into that, let's preface why we're going to start with carbon dating.
Yes. The reason is that the context of evolution has a great deal to do with the age of things, the time scale.
Right.
If we have this very common objection among creationists and non-evolutionists, is that carbon dating doesn't work, that radiometric dating is so inherently flawed that to look at a time scale of millions or billions of years is completely fallacious.
Yeah, and it's to a lot of our listeners, this is going to sound strange. Maybe not a lot, some I would think, that there are people in our country that whenever they're watching PBS or, listening to NPR or reading an article that talks about some fossil evidence that is uncovered where it's dated to several million or tens of million or 100 million years, there are people who automatically discount that. That's not true. Right. That's completely baloney because, scientists don't know what they're talking about on that.
And it's not just young Earth creationists, but the whole broad spectrum of evolutionists.
Absolutely.
I wish that sounded strange, but honestly, it's so easy to picture everyone believing that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, look at the kind of country we live in. It's not surprising at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you.
Norm, I believe you were going to talk a little bit about carbon dating.
Oh, about carbon dating. Yeah. Well, as some of the listeners might know, I used to be a Jehovah's Witness when I was younger. And so I used to be a young Earth creationist. And so I was one of those people who, I had an interest in science, but whenever I heard that kind of information, I completely discounted it. And the reasoning that people will use about carbon dating is going to sound really strange. So a brief overview of how carbon dating works. Carbon is the basis of life. And so it's part of the life cycle. It's a fundamental element in all the cells in our body.
Yeah, all the major biological molecules.
Yep.
RNA, DNA, protein.
All carbon-based. We are carbon-based life.
All of it.
Now, carbon has this quirk in that a certain percentage of it, the majority of it, is non-radioactive, but a percentage of all carbon everywhere on the Earth – is slightly radioactive. And how does it get that way? Well, it gets that way because mostly cosmic rays, which part of that comes from the sun, but most of it just comes from the cosmos. This radiation that gets inundated, it creates a process in the atmosphere that results in turning some of the carbon, a percentage of the carbon on the planet, radioactive.
And this isn't just carbon. If you look across the periodic table, all of these elements have isotopes.
Right.
Some radioactive, some not. Some stable, some not.
Right.
Carbon's just one we use for a particular dating scale.
Right. So how this works with dating is that when an animal or plant is alive, it is renewing its supply of carbon in the various processes of life. And so its ratio of carbon to radioactive carbon stays constant as well. When an organism dies, that process stops. And so the proportion of radioactive carbon starts to decay, but obviously the regular carbon just stays the same. And so when you look at something that has died, you can measure the amount of total carbon in a sample and compare that with the amount of radioactive carbon in the sample, and that should be lower than the standard amount of a living thing, something that's continually renewing its amount of carbon. And that amount that it's lower, you can use that to calculate how old it is, because everything that decays radioactively does so in a timely way. There's a certain time scale, half-life, of how long it takes for radioactive, anything that is radioactive, to decay.
And it's different for every element, but it's constant for each element.
And it's known.
Yes.
So once you know the number, you can look at the ratio of radioactive carbon to regular carbon and figure out its age. Now, is this going to be ultra precise within days or something like that? You know, are you going to have CSI come to a murder scene and tell how long ago someone died? Oh, they died 3 hours ago by testing their car. No, it's not that exact. But for the purposes of things that had carbon in them. So one of the common things that is carbon dated is old wood that has been, say, partially fossilized, or basically wood remains, wood that was burned. For something that you're looking at that is, you know, going to be very old, you know that it's going to have enough of a margin for error to give you a good picture of what it is. People who don't believe that carbon dating is accurate, this is their argument. And if you're not familiar with this argument, I expect that when you listen to this, you'll probably laugh. So here it is.
Norm, was this your argument whenever you were a Jehovah's Witness?
Yes, it was. And I did research into this, and this was one of the things. This was one of the initial first things that made me realize that I was in a religion that believed in nonsense. Here, the argument that is used is that the amount of radioactive carbon that is created is based on a fairly steady amount of cosmic rays. Of course, this can vary to some degree. And by the way, scientists who use radiocarbon dating, back in, I think it was the 60s, or I believe it was the 60s, they figured this out. They figured out that cosmic rays vary slightly.
Yeah.
And through tree ring dating and other dating methods, they were able to calibrate radiocarbon dating to be more accurate. I'll talk about that in a minute. But
well, and there are other sources of error as well. Sometimes people will cite volcanic eruptions.
Even pressure can change.
But for the most part, these are not critically undermining of the whole process.
Right,
itself.
Right. We'll talk about that shortly. But you know, those kinds of errors result in an error factor of a few percent. So if you date something at 1.4 million years, it might actually be 1.35 or 1.42. But, you know, it's not that different. In order for young Earth creationists to be right, when you date something at 1.4 million years and it was alive, then you've got to well, scale that back to about 6,000 or so.
Yeah.
That's a huge factor of error. So how do they account for this? I'm not kidding. The argument is that before Noah, the flood of Noah, the earth was surrounded in a heavy canopy in the atmosphere of water.
I have heard this.
Yep.
And that heavy water canopy drastically reduced the cosmic rays, therefore drastically reducing the amount of radioactive carbon in all forms of life, making it look much, much older than it is.
Where do you want me to start explaining why this is wrong?
Oh, and this is still... This is
Norm, is there an explanation for why that water is no longer in the sky because it rained for 40 days and 40 nights?
Well, oh, yeah, gravity. It's all on the Earth.
Yeah. Well,
no. Well, this is still...
they've thought of everything.
If you look up Young Earth Creationist lectures, this is still an argument that's used.
Oh, yeah.
By very popular creationists like... Ken Ham. I forget their names so easily.
They're a popular creationist?
I remember Ken Ham's name because it's Ham.
Yeah.
But you'll hear the same ideology from the Creationist Museum.
As a side note, that's one of the things that's so funny when you leave a religion like that. Before that, you thought that every argument that you ever heard was invented by people in your own church.
Yeah.
And then when you are out, you realize actually there are lots of churches that are reproducing this shit, that are saying this kind of stuff. It's not actually that unique. It's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, well, look, I mean, let's indulge the idea that this happened. Then what would you find in the fossil record? Well, you would find you can carbon date things that are only a few thousand years old.
Yeah.
Like as in 1,000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
More recent than I don't know exact numbers, and I apologize for not being very precise.
It's in the thousands
very
or tens of thousands of years.
No, but the short end, I think you can date to something like 800 or 900 years, and then
like
closer
that.
Than that, then it becomes a little not quite as accurate.
Right.
But I think probably at this point, it's probably accurate to a few hundred years.
Well, yeah, like the Shroud
must
of
have,
Turin. They used carbon dating to show that wasn't from the time of Jesus 2,000 years ago.
Right, right. That's in carbon dating's wheelhouse there, right? But regardless, if you were... I think that the upper range of carbon dating is something like 15,000 years, something mm-hmm. like that. So if this were true, then you would find fossils that were normal. You know, you could date them to 4,000, 4,500 years, etc. And then all of a sudden, every fossil you found older than that would just look hundreds of millions of years old. There would be nothing in between.
Yeah.
If that theory was correct, obviously that's not the case. We find... fossil evidence of all kinds of things.
We see a scale.
Yeah.
From younger to older to older.
Yeah. Now, by the way, as a side note, I want to make sure I don't make a kind of glaring technical error. If a bone has been 100% fossilized, you can no longer carbon date it.
Yeah, you have to go to the surrounding rock.
Right, because it's completely mineralized. And you can't carbon date surrounding rock either. You have to find something that still has carbon in it. But there's a fair amount of material that you can. Again, wood is common. So, you know, if a caveman had a fire, and then you can carbon date that kind of stuff.
And there are other dating methods as well that go back further.
I was just going to ask you minerals. This, is what kind of things compete with carbon dating? I mean, that's pretty universal as far as I've heard. I don't know any other things really for like dating human beings and that sort of thing and dating life forms. It's all carbon-based, right? Like
no.
No.
So you have carbon dating. Argon, potassium.
Oh, carbon. That's right.
Carbon can only go back so far, and it has to do with the decay rate of the isotope. Carbon decays too fast. So after – I don't know the upper end of the time scale. It's not important. But after so many millions or hundreds of millions of years or however far back it goes, it no longer becomes useful. And you have to rely on an isotope that decays much slower. So carbon dating can only get us back so far. When we want to talk about dating epochs from dinosaurs and things like that, we're never talking about carbon dating. That's far too old.
The half-life of carbon's about 5,000, 5,500 years old, something like that.
5,000? So, yeah. So, with carbon, we're talking about probably the upper limit being tens of thousands of years then. depending on the method, depending on the sensitivity of your equipment.
At a certain amount, there's not enough left for an accurate measurement.
So the method itself is radiometric dating. And each element may have its own mechanisms of replenishment or its own reasons for its particular ratio.
And here's the key thought here. These things reinforce one another.
Yes.
So if you find a fossil that is also next to partially petrified wood or some other kinds of remains, so you can date each of those things. And you will get corroborating dates. So for example, volcanic rock, once it starts to harden, a clock is ticking.
Yeah.
And you can date that rock. Well, a lot of times an organism or an animal will die in a volcano, and it will get covered up. And so you date the rock and the other remains using different methods. They tell you a similar answer, and you can start to calibrate all of your dating methods. These are part of one kind of science. Mm-hmm. Dendrochronology, right, the dating of tree rings, you can take a ring and look at the pattern, and you can find that pattern in other tree rings going to your own living tree.
Yeah.
And from that, you know, each ring is a year, basically. You can get a string of tree rings dating back for thousands of years, and they have. And then if you find that pattern in old piece of wood, partially fossilized, petrified rather, then you can carbon date that, and then you have a way of knowing that exact carbon ratio for that year.
Right.
And they've already done this.
Right.
Yeah.
So overall, I mean, look, we don't want to make this into a purely scientific kind of show, because none of us are – well, you're a scientist. You're a chemist.
True.
The rest of us are not. From just the non-scientist point of view, or say the science hobbyist, the idea is that in broad strokes, this is a unified science, and these people know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They've been doing it a long time.
It's not just this one approach. We have multiple corroborating dating methods from the fossil record, from tree rings, like you said.
Right.
There are many different contexts, the geological record.
There can't be that many idiots in science.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
You would hope.
And it would be an astounding coincidence that different methods of dating would all give us similar answers.
All the wrong answers, right? That would not be – that would be beyond astonishing.
The same and the wrong answer.
Yeah.
Astounding coincidence.
Yeah.
Now, what's – while we're on the topic, I do want to talk a little bit about error in these measurements. In doing a little bit of research, reading some of these creationist sources and anti-evolutionists. I need another word for that because it's. Really
I like
hard
that
for
word.
Me to say. Okay.
Yeah.
You find that people will point out, well, carbon dating dated us back to, or some other form of dating, put us at 8 billion years. Whereas molecular evidence put us at 7 million years. Why can't scientists agree?
Not 8 billion years. No dating method is
million.
Put us. Oh, okay.
I thought
okay.
I said million. And so they will point out that there's a lack of congruity between these ideas.
Right.
With every method, there is some degree of error, 5 to 10%. And that means that you're not always going to have perfect answers that overlap each other.
Right.
The fact that you have three different methods putting it at 8, 8.5, 7, 8.4 million years, that's extremely good evidence.
Yeah.
And it's pretty good because we're looking back in time using these methods. With any analytical method, you expect errors. I do this on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I compare methods, and I never get the same answer on two different methods,
right.
But I get a statistical...
In the laboratory.
Right.
Yeah.
But I get statistical overlaps where we see that two data sets are not statistically significant, that there's enough corroboration to say that we've got fundamentally the same answer.
I imagine every once in a while you get an anomaly where something measures just completely wrong. And
absolutely.
Sometimes you don't even know what happened.
You get these outliers, and there are statistical means of dealing with those as well.
Mm-hmm.
You expect with a degree of error to get outliers.
Right.
If you got no outliers, you never got that weird data point ever.
That itself would be suspicious.
That would be very odd.
Yeah.
But we expect random outliers.
Right.
It's not a bad thing.
What I think should be said on this subject is that there's literature out there that will show outliers of a case of someone doing carbon dating on someone's clothing and not knowing what it was and saying, oh, well, this is 3,000 years old. I bought that shirt yesterday. and things like there are. You can read these kinds of silly cases of bad data, and that's really all it is. It's data mining. It's cherry picking particularly bad examples. Again, this is expected in all of the scientific measurement kinds of things, and if you didn't get that, there would be something suspicious.
If you're outlying,
it's pretty common for people to do this and try and take science down a peg too by sorting those kind of anomalies and data mining like this. You see it a lot, I think, nowadays in the climate change movement, with people who are always pointing out that scientists used to think one thing a while ago and now they think something different, as if that's somehow a bad thing to revise your to revise your hypothesis in which you believe whenever you have new information that's given into you.
Right.
It's almost like they use the scientific method to they use the scientific method as evidence against the scientific method.
Yeah.
When we see this with alternative medicine, if you do the same study on the same ineffective treatment over and over and over, some will be a little positive, some will be a little negative, and occasionally a study will show a really positive or a really negative result.
Yeah.
But if you look at the entire data set, you see a mean with most of your observations correlating to a particular average.
I suspect that people don't like this about science, but that because they expect science to be more solid answers. And since science is kind of the establishment, it's almost like Schadenfreude, almost.
Yeah.
Where you are happy to see the establishment fail.
Sure.
Science is challenging what they consider to be solid answers.
Yeah.
They're told all their lives that religion has given you the solid 100% answer.
Right.
Then you have science saying, that's not really true. It's kind of this. And I think it's the kind of murky area that is expected. And, I think scientists would say this, it's a good thing about science that it revises itself like that, But for them, you're challenging what they consider to be a solid answer with something that is not 100%.
Yeah.
Right. It also puts us in a difficult position because we're challenging a sensitive idea. People who are anti-evolutionists are sensitive just to this idea that you're an animal, that you evolved from apes, that you're not special. The universe wasn't created for you.
Right.
I'm kidding.
This is sensitive. And so when you say, we descended probably from Homo habilis.
Right.
And then, how sure are you of that? Kind of. 80-20.
Yeah.
They're like, ah!
Right.
That's terrible.
Right.
And it's really not. This is what we expect. We expect that probability and our certainty to increase as we make additional observations.
Yeah. The moral of the story is deep time, there's a tremendous, ridiculous amount of evidence for deep time. That's just the idea that the Earth and all life on it, including us, is very old. I mean, we're not actually that old, but certainly not 6,000 years.
Yeah.
So deep time is pretty well established. And Richard Dawkins, I think, recently said something like about evolution. I'll say it about deep time. If you find someone who doesn't believe in deep time, they're either ignorant, an idiot, or crazy.
Yeah.
And being ignorant is not a flaw. That's just a shame, but that probably most people are simply ignorant of the evidence.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence, and it takes time to sit down and read and research and understand what's going on.
But there is an isotope of idiocy in that.
There absolutely is. But it doesn't seem to decay.
No. It has a constant renewal rate.
It's rather like cancer.
It's almost like a self-perpetuating process. It's like
it's expanded faster than the universe.
It's like stupid fusion.
Wait. All right, I think we should move on to the next question.
Next question. Do you want to ask this one, Norm?
Oh, sure.
All right.
Should I do it in a funny voice?
You should.
If we evolved from apes, why are there still apes?
So this is a relatively easy question to answer. And if somebody asks you this question, you can generally assume that they don't know very much about evolution.
Obviously.
That they've misunderstood something fundamental.
They usually phrase it as, if we evolved from monkeys, why are there still monkeys? Which means they don't understand it at all, because we didn't evolve from monkeys.
Sure.
Chalmer worded this better than that it should have been worded.
Damn.
Yeah.
Dumb it down. Dumb it down. Take it down to the level. You're smarter than a fifth grader here. Take it down.
Way too much correct grammar in this. And then all these questions.
I ain't no descendant from no damn.
When he asks us to read something, we'll just try to interject some errors. Okay?
Well, when I ask
we're on
read,
the job.
When I ask you to read me the question, don't point out that I wrote the question.
Oh, okay.
Don't point out his decay rate of his stupidity.
I know the answers already.
All right, so Chalmer, do tell us, why are there still apes if we evolved from apes?
So this just has to do with, either geographic barriers or behavioral barriers. We'll use an example for geographic first. If we take a species that starts out as one species, and then let's say an earthquake or a flood that creates a sea or a mountain range or something like that creates a geographic barrier where one species, one population is isolated from another population of the same species. Now we have two different populations with different selection pressures on those two populations. One population may be facing selection pressures that don't alter them considerably from their original trait,
right?
Or even if they do. The other population is going to have different selection pressures. They are in a different environment now, and even if it's the same environment, we can have sexual selection. We can have other environmental factors that don't have to do with the geography.
This is just speciation in general. Yeah,
this is how species can evolve.
Mm-hmm.
One species does not replace the species it evolved from. That's not the way it works.
Right.
An ancestor that's very similar to the thing it descended from can coexist with a very different species that also descended from the same ancestor.
Right.
So the other example would have to do with behavioral. We have big cats living in Africa. We have cheetahs and lions.
And
others.
Bears, oh my.
What, ocelots? They're from Africa, right?
I was going to say the same thing. Ocelots, yes.
And some of them are primarily nocturnal. Some of them are primarily sun-ernal. I don't know the other.
Sun-ernal. You chemist.
I don't know the type
of all of his study in my night, mind. Nick. It's okay. Well,
this is what happens when you ask a chemist a biology question.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
So
the sun is biology.
They come out in a time of the day that's like totally opposite of night, whatever it
is. Anyway, so lions come out during the day, and they breed during the day. They hunt during the day. They interact with each other during the day.
Right.
There's very little opportunity for them to interact with big cats that are nocturnal.
Right.
It does happen. We have seen this happen.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that different species are species that can interbreed isn't necessarily a complete definition.
Yeah.
Cheetahs and lions and tigers can, for the most part, interbreed. But they don't, because they're just occupying the same environment at different times.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And it's frowned upon in the South, that kind of interracial marriage.
Well, you gave the technically correct answer. There's a great video on YouTube, and we'll put a link up with this episode, about it's called 10 Responses to Creationist Arguments.
Yeah.
And they answer this very simply. They say that asking if we evolved from apes, why are there still apes, is identical to the question of if America was founded by the English, why is there still England?
Yeah.
Which is a stupid question.
Well, English.
There's another version of that answer. It's if God created us out of dirt, why is there still dirt?
Sure.
Yeah.
We could just keep this going.
We should.
If beer is made from water, why is there still water? There shouldn't be any.
I like
but
that.
But we're glad there is to make more
beer.
Be
all beer.
If smartphones
don't get us wrong,
we're
happy.
Why are there still laptops? Oh my God, it's everywhere. Should we move on to the next question?
The devil wants you all to think.
Okay.
Like that one's been
Joel, do you want to read the next question?
Sure. I'll read the next question as I stall while I pull it up.
There you go.
Next question. Chalmer. I'm going to read this exactly as it's stated on the page, then I'm going to fix it.
Don't do that.
Why about the missing link and gaps in the fossil record? Okay. So
Chalmers not the perfect writer that we thought he was.
Apparently.
No, not at all. Okay, let's ask it the right way. What about the missing links and gaps in the fossil record?
I like this question a lot. Think that, and by the way, I just want to be, I'm not being synthetically charitable. I'm genuinely charitable to some people who question evolution. Some of these questions are good questions. The question of the idea of missing links and gaps in the fossil record, I think is a very good question.
I agree. And there's some misconceptions when we talk about transitional forms, a missing link, and we have some definitions we need to cover. But I think it's a fair question.
Absolutely.
Because really, the fossil record, what we know about it kind of depends on its completeness. It can never be 100% complete. But if we have no fossil record versus a little bit of a fossil record versus a lot, right, we know more.
Right.
So as for the evolution of hominids, we actually have quite a lot of fossil record when we're talking about the division first from, well, from chimpanzees and humans. That's our most recent common ancestor is chimpanzees. Or we share a most recent common ancestor, I should say. They are not our most recent common ancestor.
I gotcha.
We just share one.
We're the most closely related to them.
Yes. Okay. We have a good number of fossils there. Going back a little further, we actually don't have very many. We're talking about apes and orangutans, which in that order we share a common ancestor with afterwards, after chimpanzees.
Right.
We're talking about species that lived in a primarily tropical environment. Tropical environments are not nearly as...
conducive to fossil making.
Conducive to fossil making as, say, a dry savanna.
Yep.
We still get fossils, but there is a big gap in that fossil record. But when it comes to man evolving from some precursor ape-like form, that's pretty much settled with the fossil record. We do have what you might call mini transitional fossils. The exact lineage is still under debate, but the proposed lineages are very probable. They're very likely, given what we know currently.
Right.
One of the primary objections here is that there's no missing link. People usually talk about the missing link between us and apes. In fact, the vast majority of hominid fossils we found are some kind of missing link. Some of them aren't a link at all. They are some sort of offshoot on the tree. They share a common ancestor with us, but they've gone extinct.
Right.
But they still have those transitional qualities from the same ancestor that we do.
Right. Here's my comment on this. In order to be a reasonable person, when you're dealing with a theory of like evolution that results in a branching tree of connectedness, and there, at a certain level, if you don't have enough fossils to provide evidence, then the question of, well, where are the links between species and branches is a perfectly legitimate question.
Absolutely.
But that kind of question can turn illegitimate rapidly if your reasoning is the following. Okay, let's say that there is a fossil here. I've got my, you can't see this, but I'm using my fingers to like display a distance. You've got a fossil here and you've got a fossil here, and you say, well, where's the link between them? And sure enough, some researcher, some archaeologist, some paleontologist finds a missing link in between. Technically, you've now created two more opportunities for a missing link. And so you could now complain, well, where are the missing links between those? And now it's doubled. And obviously, this now becomes not a legitimate form of reasoning.
Like to call that multiplicity of gaps.
Yeah. And we've reached that point with the fossil record between apes and humans.
Right. And really, this is a question that isn't just about human evolution. I mean, we're in this episode, we're talking about human evolution. But people who make this accusation about the entirety of the fossil record.
Yeah. And for some aspects of it, it's quite true. We do have a very incomplete fossil record, especially for early life forms that were entirely soft tissue organisms.
Getting better all the time, though.
Yeah.
I read in Jerry Coyne's book, Why Evolution is True, that at this point in time, we've discovered over a million fossils.
Oh, we haven't even begun to catalog all the fossils we found. People make discoveries in museums on fossils they dug up 20 years ago. We have tons of fossils.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, here's my analogy for this. It's kind of like the bit rate on music. At a low bit rate, you know, if you got an MP3 file that has 90, why am I forgetting the term for this? 90 bit.
Bit.
Bit rate. That's going to sound like crap. Go up to 128, 192, higher bit rate. What does that mean, by the way? Well, that means that the music has been sampled a higher number of times. So when you hear a tone, it's got many more pieces to make that tone, and it makes it therefore more accurately. It's the same with the fossil record.
Yeah.
The more fossils and more diversity you have, the more accurate the general picture is. And at this point, the picture is becoming quite accurate as far – and there, sure, there are certainly gaps, but the overall picture is reaffirming evolution every time.
Certainly.
Pretty much.
It's you know, devil in the details. Their fossil record is biased towards conditions conducive to fossil formation.
Right.
Right.
So we see gaps for species that evolved in – tropical environments.
And there are anomalies, and there are also a couple of hoaxes that particularly ambitious people basically cooked up fossils that turned out to not be real.
Yeah.
But again, these are not that is not good evidence to
outliers.
Right. Those are kind of a different form of outliers, sure. But absolutely.
Take your analogy with the bitrate. Mm-hmm. You actually can watch the evolution of that. If you look at the invention of the television,
mm-hmm.
from 1950 to about now, you can see a more or less smooth transition from extremely low quality black and white picture all the way up to resolutions that are based on the ability of the human eye.
Yeah,
to see.
Limits so of the human eye, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, look at video games. That's what I was thinking of whenever you're saying bits and that sort of thing. Look at like the kind of 4-bit technology you had in Atari and then 8-bit with Nintendo and on and on and up. You know, everyone was crazy whenever Sega Genesis was 16 bits. You're like, holy cow. And on and up from there, I see that kind of evolution with it.
Yeah.
So that brings up the next question that I want to talk about regarding fossil record for humans.
Are you going to read this one?
I'll read this one.
Okay.
Well, aren't all fossils so far in the human tree arguably either just apes or humans? You see this one quite a lot. You will see many creationists try to argue the finer points of each individual fossil find. They say, well, this falls well within the statistical range of what we would call a human abnormality. This is just a person with a tiny brain. Or this person had a skeletal deformity.
Right.
That made
them ironically being said by a person with a tiny brain.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting though that they'll almost cut off the branch they're sitting on? Aren't they saying that?
Absolutely.
Well, evolution is true here, but not here, and it's not quite a micro macro distinction.
Sure.
But they're definitely trying to saw off the branch they're sitting
on. When they're trying to use statistics a bit, you know, they'll say the average brain capacity and brain capacities in general are highly variable in a particular species. In humans, I believe it's.
We don't want to use the word capacity. We want to say size, because you can't judge brain capacity by a fossil.
Let's talk about volume, because I'm going to give you volume specifically. About 1,100 milliliters to 1,700 milliliters, or cc's. That's mils, right? Yeah, so about 1.1 liters to 1.7 liters.
Huh.
This has to do
with... I'm going to use a bathtub and measure my brain.
Okay.
No, actually, I can't do that, right?
You'd have trouble.
Because I
you
couldn't
have that skull in the way.
We would need you to be dead.
That would be a problem.
So that we could insert some.
How could one do this through an X-ray? If you just wanted to find out the size of your own brain,
you can distinguish tissue from brain where the bones.
Like an MRI could probably help you, right?
Yeah.
I've had a brain MRI.
So we have highly.
It found something.
Did they?
A brain.
Oh, that's good. Confirmed. We were suspect.
Always skeptical.
And so you see a high variation even among an individual species. And so we have a statistical range with the probability. The average is maybe 1,400. But a child will have much less than an adult.
Right. Right.
You might say, well, some people have offered this old argument that women have smaller brains than men. That's not really true. It's just it's sort of randomly variable based on your own individual body size. It doesn't really correlate particularly well with gender or race or geographic distribution.
Usually when you find a fossil, you find multiple bones, not just one kind of bone.
Sure.
So I don't know this as a fact, but I'm pretty sure that most of the time when you find a primate fossilized skull, you find other bones nearby that you can use to judge the size of that animal and therefore correlate it with the size of the head to tell if, for example, it's a young or a child or
sometimes
adult. Yeah,
not always.
The bone that they most use or the one that they like to use the most for that is the femur.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, they use the femur quite a bit. Sometimes we have some specimens that are based entirely off a single jawbone or some teeth.
Sure.
But let's talk about the major players that we do know about that we have skulls for, because we're talking about cranial volume. So with humans, we have 1,100 to 1,700. We have a group of fossils that we've classified in a particular group, say the Homo group or the Australopithecines, and we see another range, say 900 to 1,200 or 550 to 800 based on the specimens that we have. Well, what some people will say is that if we look at some of our more recent precursors, Homo habilis or Homo erectus, they'll say, well, their brain capacities average maybe 900 to 1,200. Mm-hmm. Well, that's within the statistical range, let's say within so many standard deviations, that there's a probability that this was just a guy that
that's
was
just
really,
a person
with a really small brain. He just had an abnormality.
Yeah.
This doesn't work for a number of reasons. One has to do with the statistical range. The idea that multiple specimens from a particular time period based on fossil evidence, based on geological evidence, based on carbon dating or what have you, would all place this particular group of, that there would be some fossil bias towards people with tiny brains in this particular period.
Right.
That doesn't seem very likely.
No, not at all.
And then also the fact that the brains seem to get statistically smaller as we go. We don't see a group that's just sort of really smart apes and really dumb people. We see a gradual transition through the fossil record of increasing brain size.
Yeah.
We could say that the ones in the middle are within five standard deviations of the brain size for modern Homo sapiens. Five standard deviations is a lot.
Right.
That's not probable, especially if you have multiple specimens.
Huh.
Unless there was just some particular area in Africa where people were just really, really stupid. The other reason this doesn't work is because of the morphological.
Is this maybe during the punk rock era?
Sure. Yeah, I like punk rock.
It almost seems like they view evolution.
It explains why those questions are written that way, doesn't it?
It almost seems like they view evolution as an intelligence map, like of, say, of the United States, whereas you start from New York and work your way down to, say, Jacksonville, Florida, the intelligence seems to drop significantly as you go down. But it's always a nice little gradient.
The Mile High Sanity Project does not necessarily endorse the views of Joel Thompson.
No.
Although they will agree with him from time to time.
Anyway.
Apologize to any Floridians.
The other problem is morphological. We have people born today with, what's the word? Problems. Small brain size.
Sure.
Any number of morphological problems.
Yeah.
Dwarfism, things like that. And people born with small brains don't necessarily have the short noses and high eyebrow ridges that we see in apes.
Mm-hmm.
We see that these features coincide as
it's not just brain size that is being looked at.
We see a reduction of jaw size that correlates with teeth size and that has to do with diet and a changing diet. We see the use of tools that arises with larger brain size.
Aren't there differences in the brow as well?
Yes, the brow size. If you look, you can just see looking at a chimpanzee or an ape, they have very prominent brows. And if you look at the skull, it's extremely obvious. We almost go straight down from our forehead to our eyes. With chimpanzees, you see a very prominent eyebrow ridge.
Right.
You also see along the top of the head in the center, you see a crest. That crest gets smaller through the fossil records as we move towards humans. That crest is an attachment for muscles that hook to the jaw.
Yeah.
Apes, they can bite your head off with their mouth. They're incredibly strong.
Long strands of muscles that go for the top of their head. A lot of people don't realize that the skin underneath your skull is layered with various muscles that go in lots of different directions.
The strength of our bite is pathetic compared to apes or chimpanzees.
Yeah.
They have extremely strong bites, and it has to do with diet. And some of our ancestors have that prominent crest, and some of them it gets smaller and smaller. That seems to kind of correlate with some of these other features, such as a reduced jaw and a larger brain size. Because as we evolved, and not necessarily, these traits aren't necessarily completely related, but we see them evolving together. That's the other problem with a transitional form, is that they don't all necessarily evolve together. You might get the reduction in jaw size by itself, and then the next step,
you
get larger brain size.
Right.
They don't all happen at once, as though it's some averaging all the way to humans. We have, it really depends on the selection pressure.
That's why you can't entirely rely on physical features to figure out the branches of the tree. You have to rely on other kinds of, so area and if you can get DNA or use DNA.
There's a my favorite example that shows how they don't just use brain size is the transition from walking on four legs to walking on two, and how that has an impact on the leg structure, the hip structure, and then the brain size.
Yeah.
All three of those things together on one particular line leading to, or the line leading to us, shows a very smooth transition in those particular features.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's all.
You're reading the next question?
Yeah.
So some people believe, I'm not going to do it in the funny voice this time.
Okay.
Some people believe in the evolution of animals, but not of human beings. What evidence is there that we actually are the result of evolution? Now, this is kind of what the entire episode is about. But more specifically, we want to use this general question to isolate particular kinds of evidence, that some of which is easy for anybody to understand.
Absolutely.
For why human beings show signs of participating in the evolutionary process.
And some of these I think people will be very familiar with. They probably learned about it in high school biology.
Right.
Some of them will be...
One at home?
Yeah. Some will be quite foreign. We're going to talk about various elements of the genetic code, from junk DNA to viral insertions to non-coding DNA, things like that. And we're also going to talk about molecular evidence as well, that we see in proteins and things like that.
But I think the first thing on the list is to talk about vestigial traits.
Yes, and this is one I think everyone's going to be familiar with.
For those who don't know, what does vestigial mean?
A vestigial trait is a trait that you've retained but no longer really seems to have any function.
Or at least doesn't have the function of its original use.
Or its original function.
Yeah, and probably doesn't have a significant function.
Right.
You don't want to make it too – yeah, you don't want to make it too strong. But
okay.
Yeah.
And this makes sense in the context of evolution. If you stop using through a lack of selection for a particular trait, and that trait is no longer useful to you, the mutations that cause it to degrade will accumulate over time, and there will be no pressure to stop it. So those traits, or that particular trait, will simply sort of atrophy across generations. Because as the genetic code becomes less and less stable in that particular region, there's nothing to tell it to stop. There's nothing that kills off the things that lose it.
If it's not harmful, it doesn't cost very much biologically, then there's not a whole lot of selection pressure to get rid of it.
And this... it happens at a certain point. If we look at whales, whales have part of a hip bone that doesn't really seem to serve them much function. Now,
I think it's actually not even attached.
Yeah, it's actually free
in
the tissue.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's free in the tissue. Doesn't seem to have any significant function.
Yeah.
Well, back when they probably had something protruding, it probably got in the way. There's
legs.
A selection pressure there.
Yeah, they got it from having legs, and then when that, yeah.
Once it becomes internalized in the tissue, it's just, it'll probably go away eventually if it has no function. But that takes generations. It takes time.
Right.
That genetic code has to degrade so that it no longer is viable to produce that trait.
Yep.
Some examples of vestigial structures in human beings. We're all familiar with wisdom teeth. Many of us have had them removed.
Mm-hmm.
If we were created by a perfect God in his image, it seems unlikely he would give us some teeth in the back of our mouth that we don't really need.
He's testing
and cause us a lot of problems.
Yeah, and cause us a lot of
problems. Those are for free. Those are extra ones.
I have not had
it's
my
a
wisdom.
Feature.
It's a feature. I've not had my wisdom teeth removed at all.
Oh, is that why you look kind of funny?
Yeah. Huh. And actually, in an X-ray, they're completely sideways and grown out.
Yeah, I have one wisdom tooth, and it is facing the wrong direction.
Yeah, and they don't cause me any problems, but they certainly don't help me with anything.
Right.
They don't help me chew
I'm annoyed
food.
By mine, even though it doesn't cause me any problems. I just don't like it.
I get food stuck in mine.
Really?
That
sounds fun.
Yeah, it's all right.
Mine's underneath the skin, so you
mine
can,
are grown out completely.
You're grown out.
You can see them. They're like
I don't want to. Nice.
I really don't think that your wisdom teeth look like a cat about to pounce on you.
They do in an X-ray.
You are not less strapped. This is
drink a little more. It'll start to look that way.
Another example, and I've read a little bit of literature about how the appendix might have. Some kind of function.
It's supposed to produce the same thing that the gallbladder produces, but in
something
very
like
small
that.
Quantities.
And
I think they thought that it when, you know, before we – well, I'm not saying this right. When we used to eat foods that contained like small granules of sand and even
something
rocks,
like that
it was a – it was a mechanism that would take that out of our system.
And our ancestors who do have this, it's much more prominent and its function is much less ambiguous.
Right.
In us, it's atrophied, and whatever function it serves, well, if you have it removed, it doesn't hurt yet.
You're better.
So even if it has some small function, yeah, it's not critical to your survival.
No.
It is a vestigial trait.
I don't mean to get off topic, but the spleen, you can live without a spleen now.
I don't think so. It causes some problems.
It does cause problems. I just wanted to make the distinction.
Either the spleen or the gallbladder.
I think they're both pretty important.
It seems like
you can live without the gallbladder. I mean, my mom's had that taken out.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, I think the spleen is pretty
I think it's
important.
The gallbladder.
What I was going to say is that you can live without it with some trouble, but you can certainly live without it, right?
Right. With the appendix, you won't notice.
Right. It's been in our own bodies, we seem to have a gradient of things that we really need. Stomach. Things we still can need but can live without, spleen. Things that we don't need at all or can live without.
Like legs.
Gallbladder.
Yeah.
Appendix, things like that.
I've heard body hair is pretty much irrelevant at this point.
Hey, well, to some of us.
Not necessarily.
I don't say that because I'm balding on top. I think I've accepted that.
I think body hair is a problematic example.
I do too.
Because, you know, for example, we have body hair over a lot of our body orifices. Well, that does serve a function of slowing down moisture from getting into there and possibly causing infections or just irritating us. And so, the body hair that you have on your arms and legs, that might be a little bit more difficult to explain. But, it does help you keep warm. And it might be the kind of thing that just looks nice, especially on males. So it participates in sexual selection. So it's a problematic example of vestigial traits, I think.
It does serve we're not on vestigial traits, but it does give us another piece of evidence from lice, as it turns out. The lice, how you can tell when we started losing our hair and became more human as we appear now.
Right, more seal-like.
Has to do with the... has to do with the speciation of what are the
different kinds of lice on our body?
Yeah, the different species of lice in our groin area in our heads.
Awesome,
and body
and body.
There's three different kinds.
Those three different species decided that they wanted to live in different parts of us.
Huh.
As our hair receded,
and they
specialized.
Became different.
Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
On our
they've
body,
adapted
so
different
that's hilarious.
Structures
evolutions
to
on top of
thickness of hair.
Huh. Yeah.
We won't go much into that. Though.
Yeah.
That's only coming of Homo Brazilian, which doesn't have anything.
How do we gracefully transition from this subject? I think my favorite example of a vestigial trait in human beings is the goosebumps response.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that when you are frightened or get a chill, that your skin gets these goosebumps is, when you think about it, that serves no survival attractiveness, no function whatsoever. So why do we have it? Well, it looks like the reason why we have it is because we used to have a lot more hair, as most of the great apes and primates do. And when you have hair, that response is useful. Mm-hmm. When you are frightened, that response automatically makes the hair on your body fluff up and makes you look bigger, mm-hmm. therefore making you look more threatening. And if it is cold, it makes the hair on your body stand up and improve insulation.
Right.
And so this was a response, and this is a response that we can see in other animals, and it does exactly that.
Yeah.
And we have that response, but it doesn't do anything because we don't have enough hair to actually make it work.
Well, most of us don't.
Yeah. Maybe Robin Williams does.
Yes, that was good. That was the end of that example.
But so... I just want to, before we get too deep into the details, and we'll probably leave this shortly, but the fact that human beings have vestigial traits does provide evidence that we are simply like other animals that have participated in the gradual change that evolution explains, instead of being directly created. If you were directly created, there would be absolutely no reason to have these kinds of things in place. It would be sheer laziness on the part of the programmer. Laziness or idiocy.
Or cruelty.
Possibly.
The appendicitis is not funny.
Right. Oh, yeah. But then even that, maybe I could see some twisted logic saying, well, that's a test. When it comes to things like goosebumps, or the fact that some of our vertebrae, I think, don't we have a
vestigial tailbone?
Right, yeah, a vestigial tail.
These
are useless.
There's some kids that are born with tails.
With tails,
There's a mutation that still allows for a little tail.
And I highly recommend that whoever's listening have a few drinks and then Google that to see some pictures. It's messed up.
Well, and the other way this helps us establish evolution is that if we look back at species we share a common ancestor with, we can see those same structures on a functional level that have been retained, and we can see why it's been retained.
Another form of a link.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it corroborates the other evidence that we have.
Yeah.
So the next part, we have, where am I? Oh, congruity amongst methods. We've already talked about that a little bit, especially with dating. We have, when we chart the tree using genetic methods versus fossil methods, we kind of get very, very similar patterns. They're not always identical, but they're similar enough that we're really probably onto something.
They overlap properly.
Yeah.
Not completely, but the debates that those kinds of things spur have to do with whether or not this particular ancestor was before or after this particular ancestor by a million years.
You can use evolution to make predictions, and they do use it to make predictions, and then they seek out evidence for those predictions, and very often they end up finding them.
Yeah, if anything, the genetic evidence, it has refined our models of the fossil record, but for the most part, it's confirmed many of our original hypotheses.
Mm-hmm.
And new fossils that we discover seem to fit in with the genetic model quite well.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next part was comparative morphology. This is kind of in the same vein of vestigial traits. We can look at the morphological traits of other species alive today, and we can see that based solely on morphology, we are probably more related to chimpanzees and apes than we are to bats or cows or dolphins.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can create an entire tree of ancestry, but we can create a map of relationship distances, and that's in that way. And what we find is that if we look at the other forms of evidence, if we're looking at genetic and the way we construct our fossil record, we see the same kinds of distances and relationships.
Yeah.
Fossil-wise and genetically, dolphins seem to be much more distantly related to us than chimpanzees.
Right.
And more related to us than, say, ungulates like cows.
Don't we have a decent percentage in common with a banana?
Well, depends on what you mean by in common.
As in DNA.
I don't know about that specifically, but this idea that if you look at the whole genome, we would be significantly different from something that is morphologically different isn't necessarily valid. We can look at,
it's not a straight percentage of DNA to
We have a huge amount of non-coding DNA. I think something like 98% of our genome does not code directly to protein. We have
that doesn't mean it doesn't do anything, by the way.
Right. It doesn't code for protein.
Right.
But it may have other structural properties, or it may aid in the expression of other genes, things like that.
Yeah.
There are many, many functions.
Right.
And when you look, you compare us to bananas, you might say, and I don't know what the actual difference is, well, we're only 80% difference. Well, the 20% that we share
is huge. Yeah. Depends on what, are you talking about
the
just the amount of the DNA being, or the actual,
We also have to look at critical functions. Yeah. There are many.
Humans and bananas, that's apples and oranges.
There are many, there are many genes and functions that are critical to life itself.
Right.
Genes that we share with bacteria and bananas and all forms of life that are extremely critical, that have to do with our basic metabolism and basic functions. Yeah. So, go ahead.
I was going to just point out somewhere along the lines of what you're saying right now. Plants, in general, tend to have more genes, just number of genes, straight up number of genes, than most other organisms. Part of that has to do with the way they reproduce. Point being, there's a tree.
Really?
I can't remember the name. Yes, I can't remember the name of the tree. Has 1,200 genes. One of the highest in all of. And it has to do with the fact that a lot of plants will there's they have a self fertilization, and that can cause, so instead of having, say, one copy where it's RNA, so two strands of RNA make one DNA, you have four strands where you have the two sets of DNA that become.
Term is polyploidy.
Right.
We essentially get the accumulation of chromosomes. Now, many of these genes are actually identical.
Yeah. Just they're redundant.
Yeah.
So
the argument that, oh, they have more DNA, they must be more complex. That's not necessarily true. Or they have less DNA, they must be less complex.
No.
Not necessarily true.
Right. But that was where I was going with it. So
yeah.
You took it there.
And I think even talking about complexity is kind of...
That's silly.
I don't think it serves much use when we're talking about...
At least it's not direct correlation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a direct correlation, and if you were to find a correlation, you would have to be very smart and lose a lot of math.
You know, while we're talking about DNA, there's this great argument for not only supporting evolution, but supporting human evolution that I learned about in the PBS documentary Judgment Day, which is – we'll put a link up on the website about this as well that the show reenacts arguments that were made in the courtroom in Dover, Pennsylvania. And they got hot and heavy about actually supporting evolution, also in discussing what science was, etc. But one of the greatest arguments that they mention in the documentary was the fact that evolution needed to explain why, if humans and the great apes share a common ancestor, why is it the case that human beings have only 23 pairs of chromosomes, but the great apes have 24? That's weird. If we share a common ancestor, the question would be, where did the chromosome go?
A recent common ancestor.
Right. That doesn't jive. So that's a question that has to be addressed. And if it's not, then evolution doesn't have a proper explanation and you can start questioning. And what they found out, and this is my understanding, this is fairly recent that they found this out, that basically this is a case of two chromosomes fusing into one. And when this happens, there are telltale signs in the chromosome, specifically there are each chromosome has in the end these things called telomeres that are signals of the end of the chromosome. And if a chromosome has fused, two chromosomes have fused into one, then you will find telomeres in the middle. And also chromosomes have in the middle of the chromosome something called a centromere, which is another marker. If two chromosomes have fused into one, you'll have two centromeres. And sure enough, in our chromosome 2, you find all of those markers. And so that's evidence, very strong evidence, that chromosome is the result of fusing two other chromosomes. That tells you where the chromosome went and just reconfirms our common ancestry with these great apes. And it's tremendous. I think that's a tremendous example of the fact that as a scientific theory, evolution makes predictions that are testable. And when you go out and actually try to test them over and over, you find that the test succeeds in supporting evolution.
Absolutely. Well, and the other interesting thing is that genetically, as far as functional genes go, we are extremely similar to chimpanzees. The differences that make us human are not huge. And so you can actually look at which two chromosomes fused from the chimpanzee.
Right.
The genes are the same.
Yeah.
We can say, well, we know that this particular chromosome fused with this particular chromosome because those genes match the exact positions in our own genome, but only on this fused chromosome.
Yeah. Things are going to get weird in genetics, to kind of take a little digression. Things are going to get weird in genetics in the next, 40, 50 years. We're going to be able to figure out what part of the code is, responsible for, skill in video gaming. And, what's responsible for, being able to get good grades or things. I mean, it's going to get...
There's a nature versus nurture.
Well, of course.
But Norm, as soon as we figure out how to stop the telomeres from decaying, we will live forever.
Oh, yeah, there's that one, too.
No, I don't think so.
Well, let's save that for another episode.
Okay.
What is aging?
Yes.
And is there any way that it could be... paused or stopped, reversed?
Certainly in theory, but practically speaking, I think we're a very, 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 very long way.
Let's not.
Okay.
Okay. Don't take the bait.
Okay. I'm not taking the bait.
Okay.
So, ape versus human genome. That was kind of the point I wanted to make there.
Mm-hmm.
So, the next one is I want to talk about endogenous retroviruses.
Huh.
This is one of the ways that we can look at the accumulated variation with other species alive today and get an idea of descendancy. And we can also look at some of our finds of human ancestors that we still have.
Before we get too far, what is a retrovirus?
So when we talk about an endo... I should define what it is.
Let's do that.
An endogenous retrovirus is essentially a segment of viral code that has been incorporated into the human genome or any genome, and it has since become inactive. It no longer has viral capacity. It's simply perpetuated in a non-functional form.
Before we get too far...
Sure.
I just want to comment on how fucked up that is.
It is.
The fact that our DNA has bits and pieces in it from basically parasites that have attacked us in the past.
8%.
Because, Norm, we are the Borg.
I'm not.
That is messed up.
The current estimate is that 8% of your genomic DNA is comprised of degraded viral remains that have inserted themselves into your genome. And
Wow, our antivirus software is not working very well, is it?
No. Right now they're getting a free ride.
That is crazy.
And this is not necessarily a bad thing. This extra non-functional genetic material can actually have evolutionary impact. Sometimes positive. It serves as sort of free junk that we can alter. And I don't have a specific example, but I know there are some theories out there about how it's had a particular impact.
Huh.
Or it's,
that's
it's
just fascinating. I'm just kind of jealous of people who work in genomics.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, we can look at the we can figure out when these things incorporated themselves into our genome by looking at the genetic codes of other species that we share common ancestors with.
Oh, that's crazy.
Now, we expect, let's say, that this particular virus incorporated itself into our genome 80 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, it's there's no pressure to keep it from mutating, and so it changes over time. We get base pairs substituted out, and it slowly degrades until it becomes nonsense, complete nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we look, if it incorporated itself in our genome 40 million years ago, and it's changing at a fairly constant rate over time.
And when you say us, you mean primates, not human beings, because human beings are not that old.
When it incorporated itself into the genome of an ancestor we had,
that we had
40 million
gotcha,
years ago,
gotcha,
which
yeah,
would not
yeah.
be necessarily primates.
Okay.
But we can say, well, if it's accumulating mutations over time, we would suspect that in chimpanzees, which we share the most recent common ancestor with, mm-hmm. it would be the least different when compared to humans.
Huh.
And it would be more different when compared to apes, and even more different compared to orangutans, and even more different compared to gibbons, and even more different compared to monkeys.
We can edit
Go ahead.
This out, right?
Yeah, you can edit.
Give me just a quick time scale. If the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago, and he's talking about an ancestor that's 40 million years old, there's no way it's a primate.
I had a...
earliest primates are no earlier than... Fuck yeah.
I did
five,
have
six
scale.
Million years? I think it's more than that.
You know...
We're talking about the primitive
this is all going to get edited out, but I just want to mention something that is seriously fucked up.
What's up?
Google, how old are primates? The first website you get... Oh, no, okay. I thought it was a creationist website, because it starts off talking about 6,000 years. And
that would have been very sad.
Wow, yeah, I was about to get really upset.
Call Google.
I'm going to write them an angry letter.
Oh, the primate lineage goes back 65 million years ago.
Primate lineage goes back 65 million.
So the first...
An actual primate.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what that means.
Yeah, the first primates were 65 million years ago. They were not similar to apes or chimpanzees. They were small, tree-dwelling
animals. Well, right.
Probably like marmots or something.
Yeah.
I heard a lot of early mammals looked like reptiles. one point.
Really?
Their skin and all
that. Oh, yeah, we're talking about...
Because of the kind of environments they lived in, they would have had kind of skin that looked really tough, like almost scaly, but it wasn't really scales. It was more like a skin.
That's what I'm saying. When I hear
you're full of
primate...
Shit.
No, he's right.
He's full of shit.
There's a particular genre of... I forget exactly what they're called, of very reptilian-looking... They're not technically dinosaurs. But if you were to show a picture of it to most people, they'd say, oh, that's a dinosaur.
Huh.
But they were warm-blooded, and they have... skeletal features that are in common with mammals rather than reptiles.
Yep.
I forget exactly what
they're called. No, you guys are full of crap. I got to go pray now.
Good luck. Let us
know. Jehovah's Witness Protection Program.
Let us know if you find any answers. I'll Google it. You pray. We'll see who gets the answer faster.
Nice. Good one.
What's the saying? Shit in one hand and wish in the other. See which one fills up first.
I have not heard that one. I'm thinking we're going to keep this.
I've completely been sidetracked. Where the hell was I?
We were talking about endogenous retroviruses.
Oh, that's right.
Which this is fascinating to me.
And
I think this is really cool.
These changes, they accumulate over time. And we can just look at the number of base pair differences in a particular segment of genome that we know is viral.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways to know that a particular genetic segment is viral. Viruses have very particular properties in their genetic code.
I understand.
Or their RNA code. And this is extremely interesting because it very well corroborates the same sort of conclusions we would reach based on morphology.
Mm-hmm.
We would definitely say that dolphins are less related to us than chimpanzees, and we find this very same thing on the basis of endogenous retrovirus.
Yeah, just imagine that you're a detective for the police force and you're trying to put together the various pieces of a crime.
Yeah.
Things start fitting together. That's what creates for a good explanation. And this is one more piece that fits together.
And this is research from the last 10 years, I think.
Yeah.
People have been trying to set up a lineage just of evolution in general, not just human evolution.
Right.
Where they've placed these things in particular places, and research based on our genome in the last 10 to 15 years confirms it.
Yeah.
Not every little detail of it, but the vast majority of it. We're never going to find anything in our genetic research that suddenly says, oh, we actually descended from dolphins and we're much less related to chimpanzees. That's very unlikely.
Was that your dolphin impersonation? Yeah. Hang your head in shame.
I'm sorry.
And we can use this strategy on many, many aspects of the genome. Not all of them. There are some aspects that there are selection pressures that cause variation to be less so, or something to be conserved, so you see almost no change, such as in genes that have critical functions to life. We see much, much less variation. Mm. But we can do this with huge segments of the genome, and they all agree. There's no part of the genome where if we look at change over time that says that dolphins are more related to us than monkeys.
Right. This makes
Survey
me
says.
Get, yeah, this makes me want to get my genome sequenced, by the way. You can do that.
Yeah.
It's right. I think the cheapest now is something like $1,500.
Really?
Which, you know, I don't think Laura's going to let me do that yet. But when it gets a little cheaper, I might have it sequenced.
In a couple of years, I think there's a company that's getting it down to something like a few hundred.
Yeah. That seems like fun. I want to see what kind of endogenetic retrovirus I have.
There's another area that we can use this. And this strategy is essentially what's called a molecular clock. When we're talking about changes in DNA, changes in RNA sequences, it's not just the DNA. We can also look at functional proteins over time. And they've done... many studies with this. I think the first...
Okay, you've lost me. You've got to explain this a little bit more at the beginning.
Okay. So DNA codes for RNA, which then codes for protein.
Okay.
We can look at variations in protein as well in the amino acid sequence.
Oh, okay.
And
then you can use that to tell you something about the DNA?
No, well, you can just look at the amino acid sequence of proteins in two species.
Okay.
You don't even have to look at the variations in DNA. You can just look at the protein.
Nice.
And you see the same pattern.
Gotcha.
Which makes sense if the DNA does the same thing.
Gotcha.
But we see the same thing with protein. Another point I want to make about differences in DNA, it has to do with functional variants. The number of ways that something can vary and still have the same function.
Okay.
We're going to use cytochrome C as an example. This is an enzyme that is critical to metabolism.
Okay.
Now, if we look first a little bit of background on DNA, You have a sequence of code with individual base pairs. Every three base pairs codes for an amino acid.
Okay.
There are 24 amino acids, 23 amino acids. Now, there are many more combinations of code than 23, though. Multiple combinations of those four base pairs in sets of three can all code for the exact same protein.
Okay.
The exact same amino acid in that particular part of the sequence.
Okay.
What that means is that the number of variants of code that can lead to the same protein for cytochrome C in particular, I have here is 3 to 104.
Cytochrome C is...
It's an enzyme.
It's an enzyme.
Which is coded for by DNA.
I'm missing the link between amino acids and enzymes.
A sequence of amino acids is
turns
an
into
enzyme.
An enzyme. Okay.
Or
all
a
right.
protein.
Okay.
It's a
just I'm trying to build from the Legos to understand where you're going.
Because we can have, you know, two different sequences that lead to the amino acid leucine or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We have many, many combinations that can lead to the same amino acid chain.
Okay.
But what we see for cytochrome C amongst organisms is not a random combination. What we see is that from people to chimpanzees, there's a few base pair differences. When you go to apes, there's a few more. Mm-hmm. Chimpanzees, there's a few more.
Okay.
Now, if we did not evolve and we didn't share common ancestors through time with these organisms, and this was just created out of nowhere, we wouldn't expect to see that. We would expect to see all the different combinations that could lead to cytochrome C sort of randomly distributed across organisms.
Oh, I understand.
Does that make sense?
Yep, it clicked.
But we don't see that. We just see this one particular form that changes a little bit as we move across common ancestors.
It's almost like the same brand of lock in a neighborhood.
Right.
You go to a house and you see a particular brand of locks on the doors, and that tells you, adds to the idea that, well, these are all made by the same builder.
Right.
Well, you don't need a lock of that brand, but that just happened to be the way that it worked.
Right.
You're saying that this is a particular sequence of DNA that makes this enzyme in a particular way. It's not the only way to make it,
yeah,
but we find these in common ways in these primates that we're related to. Is that a decent way of looking at it?
Yeah, the more closely we are related to something, the more alike our sequence is for this exact same enzyme.
Huh.
And it's a critical enzyme. Cytochrome C is shared by... light. All living organisms need this particular enzyme. There's some variants of it when you get way back.
Right.
But for the most part, it's critical.
Hmm.
And it's more different in starfish than it is in chimpanzees relative to us.
Makes sense. Makes sense.
So many different ways to make the same amino acid. We don't see a random distribution. We see an evolved distribution.
All right. Well, should we try to answer a couple more questions?
Sure.
I actually think that the next few questions are big enough to...
They are.
...to talk about in our next episode.
I think so. Do we want to cover them so that people know what to listen for in the next episode?
Let's just
mention
give some highlights of our next episode. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to talk about on our next episode.
Coming soon.
Yeah. One, and this is one that I want to get into, aren't human beings categorically better than other primates or animals in general?
Well, yeah.
Or another way of putting it, aren't we, if we evolved, aren't we the top species? And if so, doesn't that mean that it's fair to call us different? And then from that, it can be a pseudo slippery slope argument to, you know, us being particularly favored by God in some way, or special in some other way.
Or that the way that we're special was given to us by God, that it's separate from the evolutionary origins.
What I think is funny about this argument is I would say that there are plenty of people who don't believe in creation in any form, believe in wholesale in evolution and science, but still believe that human beings are categorically special or better. And so this is not just a kind of argument that a creationist might make.
Yeah. It is different, Norm, because we'll talk about next week about how, you know, just because I'm a better person than you, it doesn't mean I'm better than all animals. I'm just better than you.
You have to prove that you're better than Norm first.
I'm not talking to you for 5 minutes.
Most definitely,
it's proven.
The next, we want to talk about hairlessness. We mentioned this a little earlier in the episode. This is actually an area of a little bit of debate in evolutionary theory.
Why do we have so much less hair?
We'll talk about the savanna hypothesis, the aquatic ape hypothesis, and we'll talk about sexual selection.
Uh-huh. The chicks like us with less hair.
Yeah.
They want us to just have hair on our face so that they can signal that's a man.
Right.
Could be.
The last thing...
Penis sometimes doesn't give it away.
Well, it's not going to stand out amongst all that hair.
I argue that it does. I'm not willing to prove it at this time. It'd
be hard to prove over the radio anyway.
Well, it would have to be hard
over audio.
Oh, we went there.
I'm sorry. Next one.
Boing.
Joel?
All right. The next thing, I guess, is this the last thing?
This is the last thing.
The last question is, have human beings stopped evolving? Spoiler alert, the answer is no.
Yeah.
I actually think this is going to be a fascinating question
for
me. I'm going to learn a lot from this because I do have the common sense notion that I suspect is probably wrong. But the common sense notion that we are messing with our own evolution with things like medicine. That there are different traits that are now kind of common, like allergies, that if we were in the wild, this would create real problems, but we seem to maintain them or perhaps even cause them.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are we doing? I mean, I think this is a substantive question, just for creationists or anything like that, just for everybody.
I'd argue to some extent that it's a result of our brain evolving to the point that we can afford.
We can
not only afford it, but we can also affect our evolution.
Right.
Yeah.
One thing causes something else to happen.
Yeah. So. As you have down here, Chalmer, the idea of artificial selection. This would be, I think, the third evolutionary mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. You have natural selection, sexual selection, and artificial selection.
Sure.
I think so.
There are other mechanisms.
I'd say that mechanism more or less as a result of us. Is there another?
Well, that's it by definition.
Well, yeah. Right. It's
right.
You know, we have more complex social societies than any other organism. And so we create unique selection pressures that are unique to the context of our social structures.
Yeah.
And so this is,
planting corn, whatever.
Yeah. And this
farm
is,
animals, that kind of stuff.
This is a subject that's, science fiction authors love. You know, we see this kind of in The Time Machine, where he travels forward in time and you see these two, this distinct division between human societies.
Huh.
And you can take this anywhere. People talk about transhumanism, integrating ourselves with artificial technology.
Yeah.
And there's so many ways you can talk about
the singularity.
And we know that we're evolving. We have specific examples across the last few hundred or thousand years for modern humans.
Yeah.
So we can make some predictions about what's going to happen. We'll probably continue to see a reduction in the jaw. Our wisdom teeth will eventually go away based on our current diet.
Well, let's not give it away.
We'll get fatter. Well,
you will.
That's more bad news. Well, those are the things that we're going to cover in our next episode.
Yep.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. As usual, thanks a lot, guys, for joining us. Chalmer, thank you for taking the lead on this. We look forward to you teaching us more in our next episode.
I'm excited.
I like learning.
All right.
Thanks again.
From us at the project here, please think responsibly.